From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tonight is the sixth and possibly the last game of the NBA Finals. The Chicago Bulls are now ahead of the Utah Jazz 3-2. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll feature an interview with the Bulls head coach, Phil Jackson, recorded last September. Then we'll hear from the man who coached Jackson when Jackson played for the New York Knicks. Red Holtzman led the Knicks to their first world championship. Now in his mid-70s, he still works with the Knicks as a consultant. Also, film critic John Powers reviews Yuli's Gold, starring Peter Fonda. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Jurors in the Oklahoma City bombing trial are beginning a second day of deliberation on the fate of Timothy McVeigh. Last week, the panel convicted McVeigh of setting the bomb 2 years ago, killing 168 people. The jurors will decide whether McVeigh will receive the death penalty or life in prison. They may also decide to authorize the judge to come up with any sentence other than death. Jordan's King Hussein, who's visiting Geneva, is denouncing a resolution passed by the U.S. House of Representatives. It calls on President Clinton to reaffirm that Jerusalem must remain the undivided capital of Israel. From Geneva, Owen Bennett Jones reports.
King Hussein said it was very sad and very unfortunate that the U.S. House of Representatives had passed a resolution recognizing Jerusalem as the undivided capital of Israel. The vote doesn't bind President Clinton, and the administration has made it clear that its policy of not recognizing Israel's 1967 annexation of East Jerusalem remains in place. Nevertheless, King Hussein said that the congressional vote was an attempt to prejudge an issue which should be the subject of final status negotiations. The United States has a tremendous role to play in the peace process, he said, but that U.S. capability had been undermined by the House of Representatives resolution. King Hussein said that Jerusalem must be an open city, constituting in its eastern and western parts a capital of both Israel and Palestine. For National Public Radio, this is Owen Bennett Jones in Geneva.
Authorities in New Delhi are counting victims from a fire that raged in a movie theater. Police and witnesses say at least 48 people are dead. One fire official puts the number possibly at 50. More than 100 people are reported to be hurt. Investigators say the fire broke out in an electric generator. Delegates to a United Nations conference on endangered species seem likely to take unusual steps to protect what's considered a valuable species of trees from loggers. NPR's John Nielsen reports from Zimbabwe.
Big leaf mahogany trees are so valuable that loggers sometimes build roadways through miles of rainforest just to get at a few of them. Environmentalists say these loggers have now taken almost all of the big leaf mahogany trees out of Central American rainforests. Brazil and Bolivia now supply most of the international market. Delegates to a United Nations Convention on Trade in Endangered Species will vote next week on a proposal to restrict the sale of big leaf mahogany. The measure is expected to pass. Bolivia supports it, but Brazil and many furniture makers say it will stigmatize their products. I'm John Nielsen in Harare, Zimbabwe.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 61.5 points at 7,772. Trading is very heavy. The Nasdaq is up 10 points at 1421. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the stock market is trading at record levels for the sixth straight session. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors are betting that interest rates will remain stable following a tame report on wholesale inflation. Producer prices unexpectedly fell in May for their fifth consecutive monthly decline. The Dow's rise is being led by DuPont, which has gained after being called strong buy at Morgan Stanley. Tobacco shares are higher for a second straight day on reports that a settlement to smoking-related lawsuits could be reached as early as next week. And drug stocks are advancing after CS First Boston and Lehman Brothers each made positive comments on Merck & Company. I'm Doug Krisner.
A study shows that an estimated $18.5 billion were put into stock mutual fund accounts during May. The investment company Institute released their estimate based on a survey of 97% of traded stock and bond funds. Netscape Communications says there is indeed a flaw in its software that could let website operators peek at files stored on the computers of website visitors. The bug is contained in Netscape's 3.0 Navigator software, which was just released this week. Negotiators for the United Auto Workers and a General Motors parts plant in Michigan are still talking. They've worked past a midnight strike deadline, trying to secure a new contract. The strike deadline has been put off indefinitely. Neither side would discuss how much progress has been made. The disputed issues include workers' health and safety, subcontracting, and overall job security. Again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 61.5 points at 7,772. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other National Public Radio member stations and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tonight is Game 6 of the NBA Finals. If the Chicago Bulls win, they win the championship. If the Utah Jazz wins, the final game will be played on Sunday. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with the Bulls head coach, Phil Jackson. Last June, Jackson led the Bulls to their fourth NBA championship in 6 years. He joined the coaching staff of the Bulls in 87 and became head coach in July of 89. He played with the Knicks for 11 years after joining the team in 1967. Jackson coaches one of the greatest players in the history of the game, Michael Jordan. This week in Game 5, Jordan scored 38 points in spite of being sick with the flu. Jackson also coaches perhaps the most flamboyant and controversial player in the NBA, Dennis Rodman. Yesterday, Rodman was fined $50,000 by the NBA for his derogatory comments about Mormons. I spoke with Phil Jackson last September and asked him about his first encounter with Rodman, which Jackson described in his memoir, Sacred Hoops. You describe your first meeting with Dennis Rodman, and he's sitting there in his chair, and he doesn't take off his sunglasses when he meets you. He doesn't stand up to shake your hand. Isn't that a sign of disrespect? How did you deal with that?
Well, it is, Terry, a sign of disrespect, but it's also kind of a juvenile behavior. You know, it might be shyness underneath all that. So Dennis and I had many occasions of bumping up against each other in play versus Detroit. And also I coached an all-star game in which Dennis had been a member. He was on the East team that I had coached, but he hadn't spoken a word the whole time he was there, except if you addressed him and talked to Dennis. And I found that Dennis had to be addressed personally before he would offer any part of the conversation. So I knew that if I was direct with him, I would get a response. And I walked over to him and grabbed his hand and said, Dennis, I know you stand up when you meet people that like you or you have respect for. And I kind of pulled him to his feet. And he smiled, just gave a little bit of a smile, but he was shy. And I know from being around him that he's a very shy person initially.
What was your approach to telling him that there was certain behavior that was going to be expected or demanded of him that might go against his nature in some ways?
You know, I just had to be really direct and, you know, say, you know, there are rules. We have rules like any other society that we have to have met. And if you bump up against them all the time, then you're going to be consistently being, you know, on the edge of either being fined or being in behavior that is going to go against the grain of our society. So you've got to find a way. Well, you know, the first day we have our center court meeting and, you know, everybody's ready to practice, shoes tied, practice jerseys on, all set up in the middle of the floor. Dennis comes out, the shirt is around his neck, but he doesn't have his arms through the holes and his shoes aren't tied, you know, so I found that Dennis would have a little behavior problem every day that generally, you know, you'd either have to smile at him or say, come on, get it together. Because it's just his behavior mode. He's not going to be part of the group. He doesn't want to be a stamp addition of the next Bulls. He wants to be an individual so desperately. But he found that I was willing to give him that little space. In fact, I called him a heyoka, which he loved, because that's a Sioux term for a backward walking or a person of different orientation. And he definitely is that.
Now, you have two of the biggest stars in basketball on your team, Michael Jordan and Dennis Rodman. You are very well known in sports for applying the principles of Zen Buddhism to your coaching. Now, Zen is about transcending ego, about going beyond ego. And being a sports star is kind of about having a big ego. I mean, it's hard to not have a big ego when you're a sports star and you're making a lot of money and the press is dying to get at you and women are throwing themselves at you. How, from a Zen perspective, do you deal with the ego of your biggest stars?
Well, you know, I think what has to be held up from the standpoint of being a coach, and especially one that's trying to be at some level conscious and aware, is a mirror. And to hold a mirror up in front of people is probably the best recognition that they can have as mirroring back to themselves what their image is. So there are subtle little things that I think are available to a coach or to a person in my position that keep or help keep a person of that level grounded. Some of them are privacy, you know, really trying to keep it as private as possible so that we can, you know, be ourselves, let our hair down, not let our so-called image or our personality be the force of who we are, but be the real person in the real moment. There's a lot of things that go into talking about the team as to who they are as personnel on the floor, what their inadequacies are and what their strengths are. There's videotape that we use as a crutch and a tool a lot of time in which you can do so many variety of things that constantly bring about the aspects and the facets of the media and television and commercials, all of which play at the same time that our games usually play on TV, which are real good tools to use. So there are a variety of mirrors to hold up.
I don't understand. How are you using like commercials and other programs as tools?
Well, you know, it's very, very easy to use a, you know, you're videotaping a game, you're showing this team the replay of the game that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And you can throw in a couple messages. You can use a commercial of Michael Jordan or Dennis Rodman or Scottie Pippen, three guys that we have on our team that do a lot of commercials, following a play in which they're involved in which they're doing something that exhibits perhaps not the character that they're demonstrating on TV or enforcing the character or the image that they have on TV. Without mentioning products, it's pretty obvious that there are a lot of them out there in which, you can use. So it's a lot of fun to use, especially Michael and that with the guru that's sitting there and they're drinking Gatorade, if I get the right commercial right. And he meets this this guru after climbing and running this mountain to this very spiritual-looking guy. So they're all those images that I like to incorporate into videotapes that are a lot of fun for me and for the guys that are in the team, because it's pretty much a basketball team is a group of guys that can let their hair down and see each other for their strengths and their weaknesses. And when they recognize the weaknesses that they each have, then they become a good team. And so coach's responsibility is to constantly hold that mirror up, and that's my job.
Do you ever say, go meditate and realize that you're more important than your ego, that you must put your ego in? You know, I mean, do you tell them, do you try
yes.
to use the principles that you follow of meditation and Zen Buddhism to try to get them to just get rid of some of that ego?
There's no doubt that we try to teach them the tool, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's real important that, you know, you carry some of your belief to the marketplace with you when you go out there. And that's something that you can't sit on or hide. So, you know, I have a professional person that comes in that I really respect that can come in and teach what we call mindfulness or focusing without using the term meditation, because it may carry some weight to
mm-hmm.
the term.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about its values that to play, its values to relieving stress, and we talk about how we can do it. We practice it as a group, but we, you know, it's not something we daily come to practice and sit on our cushions and meditate. You know, this is something that I think is where you open the door, or maybe give them the key and say, "Here, it's yours to use if you want to use it," because that's as far as I want to go as a coach. I don't want to, you know, be forceful or controlling, but, you know, allow that freedom. But there's other things. You know, we'd like to teach, you know, we'd like to teach yoga. We'd like to have, you know, a Tai Chi instructor. You know, I mean, there's other things that we'd like to have, but when you only have so much time, we think that being focused, mindful, mm-hmm. is maybe one of the most important things that we can teach or can give them as a tool. So that's one of the things we talk about. Then we sit down, and when we're going to do something that requires this mindfulness that's incorporated in our work, then we can talk about it as a group. How connected are we so that we have mindful behavior, or that we're really, you know, working from an awareness level as to how we perform or what kind of level we're performing at under stress, even in very games of great magnitude. So it's a tool that is used not only for a personal level, but it's also used at a level to help make the team a better team, I think. So that's why I've incorporated.
You said that you've tried to get players to connect with something larger than themselves. How do you do that?
Well, I do it in, you know, whatever way is, you know, a cause that's greater than, say, well, let's win the NBA championship. We want to win the NBA championship, and we want to have a great contract, and we want to have material goods bestowed upon us. Those are things that are all, so ephemeral material that to me, it's got to be something that's bigger than that. Mm-hmm. And it's every year I just think of different challenges. You know, last year, we had kind of this motto that the journey is the reward, that the reality of working day by day, practice, if it's a practice day, a game, if it's a game day, and the journey of doing this thing day in and day out is in itself the reward, and it was, because we won 72 games last season, which was an incredible feat for a team that plays 82 game schedule, to do that day in and day out.
Do you have a sense of how much of your success comes from this approach to coaching, where you're applying certain spiritual principles and so on? How much of your success comes from that, and how much of it is just much more practical things about calling plays and analyzing strengths and weaknesses?
Well, you know, I'm trying to paraphrase Yogi Berra's comment about, you know, 90% of it's mental and the other half of it's physical, or something like that.
right.
Well, 90% of it's mental and the other 50% of it's physical. The reality is that you've got to have the athletes and the players that can do this. There's no substitute for the talent, and that you have to have talented people. Yeah. That's, you know, credit goes to Michael Jordan, to Scottie Pippen, to Dennis Rodman, that they have the talent that can do what they have to do. The jollies that I get from, doing this spiritual or goal-seeking at a higher level is just, I tell them, you're just appeasing your coach and you're letting me have my fun, so that they have an idea that they're letting me have some fun while they're doing the game playing. They get all the fun playing the games. I get some fun playing mind games.
We're featuring an interview with Phil Jackson, recorded last September. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. On this archive edition, we're featuring an interview recorded last September with Phil Jackson, head coach of the Chicago Bulls. They're now ahead 3-2 in the NBA Finals. You know, professional sports is so much about money and power and, of course, winning. And those are things that don't seem that compatible with Zen Buddhism and meditation and spiritual values and so on. How do you deal? I mean, when you lose, how do you deal with that? And why is winning very important if you're trying to be in a more spiritual plane that's not about ego and so on? How do you correlate all of that in your mind?
Well, there's a lot of times we come in and we win what we call win ugly. And I don't like to use that phrase. It's just that we didn't do as good a job as we perhaps could do. And there's still lessons to be learned, but we always think there are
That means you won, but you made real blunders even though you won?
Yes, it wasn't a pleasing game. Mm-hmm. You know, we're trying to play a game at a level in which people will remember how we play basketball. That's mm-hmm. one of the goals that I say that, you know, it's one of these type of things that let's have something beyond just, hey, we won, and that's it. Let's do it in a style or a way that's remarkable. That's you know, inspiring to people, because we have that ability. We should play at that level. And there's some games that you come in and you lose, and you feel pretty good about losing. It was still a great battle. It was still a wonderful night, and you can still benefit from something that you've had that hasn't been a win. And there's some nights a win may feel just as bad as a loss. And so we don't always say that it's measured by wins and losses, but it's measured by how you play.
Did you always feel that way?
No, I don't think so. I think winning was the all-important driving motivation for me as a younger person.
And when did that change? Why did that change?
It changed somewhere in my professional career. When professional ball became a continuation of a very long season of 82 games, and I came to a basketball club that was struggling and suddenly became very good in the New York Knicks for a 7-year period of time. And during that period of time, the enjoyability of winning and the focus on how to do that became more important than just on winning, as it was when I was a rookie and this was the Knicks were a struggling team. And if you could just win a game, it was the most important thing that you could do.
What are your pep talks like before games?
Well, first of all, they're very low-keyed, and they're not pep talks. I wouldn't put them in those. It's a matter of bringing to focus what the group has to focus on. And so it may be on energy. It may be on developing enough energy for the game, but more or less it's on what we can do that strengthens us as opposed to what we can do that can take away from the opponent's ability to operate at full strength. And so it's just trying to bring key points out to a group. I have the oldest team, they tell me, in the NBA, average age over, 30. And they have probably heard every pep talk possible by the time they're 25.
Mm-hmm.
And so pep talks are usually going to leave them deflated. And, they bring their own energy to it. So what we'd like to do is bring focus. A lot of times it's just a moment of quietness, and sometimes it's a 2 or 3 minutes. So let's just be still and quiet before this game and get ourselves thinking on one as a one-man unit or a one team, have a mind of one. So just so that we can get in stride together, because it's been disjointed, we may have a hard travel schedule, the media may have been busting their seams to try and get into our locker room and have stayed too long, and we just need to focus. But for the most part, the players that are the premier players have great focusing ability, great concentration skills, and to bring everybody to that level is always important.
When you were playing with the Knicks, what worked for you best before a game, and what were some of the things your coach, Red Holtzman, would do?
Well, Red was very constant. He used to say almost the same thing before every game, and his speeches were probably at most 2 to 3 minutes. And at some point during the talk, he'd usually say, if you guys have any trouble concentrating, just nod your head so at least I think that you're focusing on what I'm saying. Or if you have to prop your eyelids open with toothpicks, don't mind me. I'll watch you do it. And he would joke about it himself, that he was saying the same thing. But what he was trying to do was trying to get us in the same kind of focused mood and concentrating on the same activity. For me, what worked best of all was to stretch and to be quiet before a ball game. That was the things that I enjoyed doing.
How were you first introduced to Zen Buddhism, and how did you start incorporating that into the game?
Well, I had a brother that was a college student, graduate student, and he picked me up at a baseball game I was playing in North Dakota. I was a senior in high school, and drove me from Bismarck, North Dakota, back to Williston. And in that very late night drive was telling me about some very exciting things that were happening in his life, and among them were the introduction to Zen Buddhism. It kind of opened my mind to a new format. I was raised a fundamentalist Christian. In the process, I started searching a little bit on my own, and you know, ended up as religion as one of my minors. I had a composite major, actually. One of my majors in college was religion. And I kept exploring until really I kind of found a group that I could sit with in the early 70s.
And that connected to the game for you right away, or did it take a while?
Well, it really did. I was disconnected from the game. Actually, you know, it was so opposed, athletics was so opposed to my spiritual life that it was kind of a schizophrenic life for me. I could play sports over here in the very world, or I could be over here wholly in the very spiritual world, in church and in the community that I was born and raised in. And the two supposedly didn't meet. And as a consequence, I think that's one of the reasons I loved athletics so much, was to get away from all this religion. And then the process of finding out that, you know, really it goes with you everywhere. When I was a little bit older, I could realize that, you know, this was something that you carry with you. You don't have to carry it on your shoulder as a chip, but you can carry it in your heart.
Your father was a minister. What were your parents' reactions to you pursuing sports professionally?
Well, my mother was a high school basketball player.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, she was a high school basketball player and a letter winner, and I often wore a sweater when I was a little kid, you know. And she liked to come out and shoot hoops, and there was some competitive, a great competitive level that she had. And so basketball was really kind of an accepted format in our family as a game, although I liked all the sports, football and baseball too. But it, as long as it didn't interfere with church, it was okay. And we had Friday night meetings in our church, and my brother, who was an older athlete, 6 years older than I was not allowed to participate in athletics because they had Friday night games in the high school basketball team. So that was a real conflict. When we moved to a new church in out of the state of Montana to the state of North Dakota, they didn't have those Friday night services. They had Wednesday and Thursday night church services to go along with their Sunday services. And so the Friday and Saturday ball games did not interfere, and it was okay. And so I was fortunate.
Did you ever go wild after leaving the more regimented life of your parents?
No. I don't think in that regard, never went wild. I did explore and was, I think, a person that liked to try different experiences, but I'm not one that went wild.
Phil Jackson is the head coach of the Chicago Bulls. Our interview was recorded last September. We'll hear more of it in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our discussion with Phil Jackson, head coach for the Chicago Bulls. And we hear from Jackson's former coach, Red Holtzman, who led the New York Knicks to their first two championships. Also, John Powers reviews the new film Yuli's Gold, starring Peter Fonda. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Phil Jackson, head coach of the Chicago Bulls. Tonight, the Bulls meet the Utah Jazz in Game 6 of the NBA Finals. Our interview with Phil Jackson was recorded last September, just before his memoir, Sacred Hoops, was published in paperback.
I want to paraphrase something that Dennis Rodman says in his best-selling book. He says, you know, in the NBA, off the court, 50% of life is sex and the other 50% is money. How do you deal with it, watching some of your players get really caught up in that off-the-court life of sex and money? You come from a much more, like, from a very disciplined background, and you're very disciplined as a coach as well. You have a spiritual side to help you and to fall back on. So what do you take a part in their private lives off the court, the part that might have to do with sex and money?
Well, you know, that's right there. That's a level sometimes of some of the people that, you know, have to live in this world of athletics. It is, and most people assume that that's really where athletics lives at, that level. But that's not so. I think athletics lives at all those levels, from the conscious to the, you know, the very mundane and the very earthy areas of our psyche. And, you know, from this standpoint, I'm able to do some things that are kind of fun with the team. You know, there's this kind of a collection of people that know that I give books out to the ball players. And we have a long road trip at the early part of the season. After usually a week into the year in November, we usually take off on a road trip for 2 weeks, covers Thanksgiving. And during this period of time, I give them books in which, you know, I make a little attempt to try and, you know, move them along on this path, you know. And one of the things I picked up from one of my teammates, Senator Bill Bradley, was that, you know, there's people want to move up. People want to be more conscious. And, you know, just from my association with him and, you know, maybe going to art museums here, some things that, you know, I wasn't really associated with when I was a young man, and learning, you know, some kind of things that were culture or taste oriented, I found myself intrigued by them. And I feel that other players, and professional players particularly, want to improve their life. They want to be educated. They go to college. A lot of them don't get through college. Some of them still want that education even when they come to the NBA. And I like to help push that along or move that in a direction they like to go.
Could you mention any of the books that you've given out?
Well, you know, one of the players I gave Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance to was John Paxson, one of our great players in the past. And at the other end of the spectrum, you know, I gave Beavis and Butthead to, you know, Stacey King, who loves cartoons and loves television.
Have you had to deal with players who grew up poor and now have big money and don't necessarily know how to handle it?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, that's quite obvious that the younger players in our league, regardless, you know, have never had this kind of money, and no one would. Regardless of whether you've grown up in an affluent family or not, suddenly have $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $1 million at your disposal is, you know, ridiculous to think about. So there's a process that goes through the NBA of young players come out of college, and the first year they buy their toys, and the second year they buy their cars, and the third year they're doing other things with their money. And it usually takes a 2 or 3 year period of time for these players to realize that all the material growth and wealth and everything else that they have has not brought them any happiness. It's brought them diversion, it's brought them some, you know, comfort, but it really hasn't brought them the kind of happiness. And they're starting to get back and think about the fact that, hey, you know, this is a career, I better be a professional. And all this has just made me want maybe to explore life a little bit deeper. And so I think that there's an awareness level that comes to players at 26, 27 when they come to the NBA. And that's one of the reasons why we're happy to have the oldest team in the NBA and not the youngest.
Well, there's a downside, of course, of the oldest team, which is that the body's a little less flexible. People start performing at a little less than their peak. How are you dealing with that? And members of your team are now a year older than they were last year.
Well, that's a good question, because that's our opponent. Our enemy is ourself, really, and if we can prepare ourselves for that, we'll be fine. We do have a great program in weights and conditioning, and we dedicate a part of our practice to that. It's not just banging heads and running up and down the court and shooting jump shots. A lot of it is physically keeping ourselves prepared and ready with massage therapists, with, you know, with stretching, with weights and conditioning. We really put a lot of energy into the maintenance, nutrition, those type of things. And then I'm a coach that has, instead of two-a-day practices, like a lot of training camps open with practice both in the morning and the evening, and the guys run 4 or 5 hours a day, we have one practice. And that one practice, even in itself, is still only, you know, a couple hours long. So it's not a teaching old dog, new tricks to old dogs. It's the fact that let's maintain this body and what we have and bring it along to a point where we can sustain it.
Phil Jackson, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry. I've listened to so many programs. It's really been a pleasure to be part of one.
Phil Jackson is the head coach of the Chicago Bulls. If the Bulls win tonight, it will be their fifth championship in 7 years. Our interview was recorded last September. Coming up, an interview with Jackson's former coach, Red Holtzman. This is Fresh Air. Red Holtzman's career in basketball predates the formation of the National Basketball Association. Now he has a place in the Hall of Fame. Holtzman learned to play in the schoolyards of Brooklyn, New York. He played professionally with the Rochester Royals and the Milwaukee Hawks. In 1958, the New York Knicks made him their scout and assistant coach. As a scout, he discovered the men who became the Knicks' star players, like Dick Van Arsdale, Cassie Russell, Walt Frazier, and Willis Reed. After 10 years of scouting, Holtzman was promoted to coach. 3 years later, he led the Knicks to their first world championship. 3 years after that, they won it again. Since retiring in 1983, Holtzman has maintained his connection to the Knicks as a consultant. I spoke to Red Holtzman in 1987, and he told me he thinks fringe players often make better coaches than great players do.
Very often, the great player has had things, he's done things so well that he expects everybody to do what he's done instantly. And many, many times these great players, they don't even know how they did it. You know, they just do it naturally and it comes up and they do it. Whereas the guy that's sitting around, he's the fringe player, he's watching, he's seeing what's going on and he's studying and he's waiting for his opportunity and he's constantly in the ball game thinking all the time. Now, the great players do that too, but I think the other guys have been more observant and don't expect you to do so much and try to teach you to do the things that will make you a better player.
Well, especially with your experience as a scout, you knew what your players were capable of doing, but it was your job to bring it out in them and to get them to do it. What were some of your techniques for getting the best performance from your players?
Well, I think the most important thing that we tried to do when I came in was to get them to play a brand of team basketball that would help us. I felt that you get teams that don't play as a team, no matter how much talent they have, they're not going to be a winning team. So that was the first thing we had in mind, is to instill pride in being part of a team type of thing. And the next, almost as important, is to get them to play good team defense, because I think if you study basketball a little bit, you'll find that there's almost never been a good team, a team that's won, that has won without playing good team basketball, good team defense. So very often your defense makes your offense, and these are the things that make for good teams, those two things. And then to put your talents in the team and use it together, do all the things together. And that's what they did. They were a very, very intelligent group.
Well, as we discussed before, you've always put teamwork above individual stars. Did that get harder to do over the years? Did it get harder to have the players really function as a team as opposed to just going for their own statistics?
I think it did. I think it got harder over the years because money became more of a factor. The money got, you know, very, very big, and you couldn't blame players for wanting to make more money or striving to make more money. And a lot of them thought that the only way to get it was to shoot a lot and score a lot. Of course, that was not always true. If they didn't have the ability to do that, they fell by the wayside. So I think that the money factor took away from that aspect of the game a little bit. But of course, still the good teams do these team things and do these team defensive things together.
Do you think that fans appreciate good teamwork as much as they appreciate someone who can make a lot of baskets, do a lot of shooting?
I think they like to see outstanding players, and they like to see players do outstanding things on an individual basis. But they like to see good team basketball, and they like to see good team basketball if it gets results. If you're out there and you're not getting results, then they're not going to buy it. They're going to say, yeah, that stuff doesn't work, you know. And I think my main job also when I took over the team was to do a selling job on them and to tell them that the stuff that I was laying down there and teaching them was going to work. And, you know, we lost a couple of games, and if we lost some more, I don't know what would have happened. You know, they might not have bought it and say, well, this guy, you know, I don't know if he knows what he's talking about. But the thing is that if it does work, everybody is a part of it, and they're proud of it. You know, all of a sudden we know something that somebody else don't know, you know, and we're pressing. Our defense was a pressing type of defense, and it was working. So that was a great thing.
Was there something that you always felt, well, if I were a coach, I would do it this way? Something like that you actually were able to put into effect once you started coaching?
Well, I think that, you know, that's inherent in everybody that's been involved in anything, you know. If you really love it and are serious about it, you're always thinking about something that you would do that would be better than what's being done. And my background was with, you know, people who had me play this type of defense, this type of basketball, this type of stuff that we did in the schoolyards in Brooklyn, you know. And I played for guys like Nat Holman, who was a great coach at City College, and I played up in Rochester. You know, so all this stuff was based on the team stuff, passing the ball and helping each other, playing good defense. So it was in my background, you know. It was always there, and I always felt that was the number one way to go.
Part of what you have to do as a coach is be a disciplinarian. What were the kinds of things that you would institute penalties or fines for from your players?
Well, that's very true about being a disciplinarian. You have to do that, but you can also make a game out of it. You know, I was a stickler on being on time. I felt that if you came on time and you thought about that, you played on time and you played better and you had respect for your teammates, you had respect for your coaches, and you had respect for yourself by being there on time. And it made a better unit, I felt. So that was one of them. And we'd give them little fines, you know, and at first, you know, $5, $10, maybe more for other things. And we'd keep a pool and let them have a party at the end of the year. But rather than making it a stern type of thing, well, you're fine, you know, and get that type of attitude, we made it a fun type of thing where the players were finding each other. They were watching the clock. Uh-oh, we got this guy, he's late, you know, and things like that. And that made it fun, but it got the result. It got them where they were on time. And also when we were playing, it got them doing the things we expected them to do. And it worked out. And it worked out without any animosity and with it becoming fun and sort of getting us into where we were some sort of a happy family. You know, usually basketball players don't stick together too long after they leave their practice sessions or the road or whatever, you know. They go their separate ways. But on the road, practice, games, we were pretty tight.
I can't imagine a $5 to $10 penalty being something that really scares the heck out of a highly paid basketball player.
No. But we did have higher fines. You know, we'd have a $100 fine, $500 fine, $200. Oh, we had that, sure.
You didn't mention that.
You know what? With today's salaries, that doesn't scare them either.
Yeah, right.
But the idea is they don't like to have their teammates laugh, you know, and say, oh, we got you. You're going to pay this fine. And they're standing there laughing. So they can't wait to get the other guy, you know. So it was a fun type of thing. I think, you know, it's like when you get a ticket, you know, you can afford to pay $30, $40. But as soon as you get it, you get a feeling like you did something that you shouldn't have done. And you're not happy about it.
Whenever you watch a basketball game on TV, there are, of course, cutaways from the court to the coach on the sidelines, who's really in a panic and shouting and screaming and urging on the players. Did you dread those cutaway shots to you?
Well, I didn't dread them because I was too busy trying to do what I could do. But, you have to have a lot of ego, and you got to be a little crazy to be a coach, you know, and you got to make a fool of yourself occasionally. So we all did that. But we don't like the word panic because we're supposed to be cool, you know, although I guess we did that too. But the cutaway shots were part of the business. And the only thing I didn't like about, and I wouldn't let people do it, is take their mics into the huddle, you know, the timeouts and things like that. I figured we ought to have some secrets, you know, and everybody say, oh, boy, I wonder what he's telling them now, something brilliant, I suppose, you know, and maybe I'm telling the guy to get the bus warm or something, and we'll be out, and we're going to go to dinner early or something like that. But you got to have some secrets, and that's one thing I didn't go for.
What are some of the typical things that you would yell from the sidelines, well, to your players, things that would be clean enough to mention on the radio?
Well, I think I was pretty clean most of the time. Most of the time, I stray once in a while. But mostly I would be concerned with what they were doing on defense because, as I said, that's where everything starts. Your defense is where everything starts and gets you into your offense. Mostly to see the ball. There's a tendency of guys on defense not to see the ball. So they would hear that till they got sick of it, you know, and that's mainly the thing. See the ball. See the ball, and then, you know, maybe a little expletive if they didn't do it after the five times or something, you know. But that's all game that went on, get up there or get back, you know, all these little things to make them alert, make them aware of what's going on, make them aware of what's coming up and things like that, because there are tendencies for people to lose concentration in sports. That's why we say, like, when you're making screens, if you make a screen, the guy can concentrate and get over it the first time. If you do it the second time, he's just about getting over it. If you do it the third time, he's maybe not thinking about getting over it, and then you get free. So you need patience defensively, concentration defensively, and you need the same thing on the offense.
You have been in basketball throughout the history of the NBA. Are there any rules that were instituted by the NBA that you think really changed the sport for the better or for the worse?
Well, the first one was that 24-second clock. I think that made it a better game for the fans, you know. And to the credit of the NBA, and they've always made rule changes that would help the fans enjoy the game more, make the game a better game, and take some judgment away from officials. That makes it better. Now, there have been many, many. They've widened the lanes at times. And they've done a lot of things. 24 seconds, as I said, and of course they play 48 minutes, and they have last 2 minutes. The clock is dead on everything, and the last minute of the half. And it's a great game in that respect. They're always trying to figure out a way for the team behind to get back in the ball game or get out front. Now, when that happens, it's interesting. People are not apt to leave as much because in the NBA, it's exciting. If you're 10 points down and there's 2 minutes to go, you could win by 3-4 points with 2 minutes. So that keeps the game great, and the players that they have keep the game great, and it's just going to get better and better, I think.
Back when you were a scout, you were scouting at Grambling College, which is a Southern Black college. And in your book, you write that it was interesting that all the players were Black, but a lot of the white students from nearby colleges had come and were cheering on the students from Grambling. And you said that you thought this really foreshadowed how the NBA would change. Would you explain that?
Yeah, well, at that time, Grambling played some of the best basketball around. You know, that was before all the big colleges were taking Black players, and they really had the best players in the country. We got Willis Reed from Grambling. And the people who were basketball fans who wanted to see good basketball came to Grambling. They went there to see it. And all these great players were being watched in the small colleges. Didn't make any difference where you went. You went to see the best players, and that's where they were. So I think that this was a sign of things that were going to happen. And it was great.
Well, I think when you started playing, there were virtually no black professional players.
There were almost no black professional players except some teams that were entirely black teams, like the New York Renaissance, who were a great, great basketball team, and the Harlem Globetrotters and the Washington Generals. They had some great, great all-black teams, but in the National League and later on, actually, the Rochester Royals, who were owned by Lester Harrison, the guy that owned my team there, was the first man to sign black players. He signed two great black players out of New York, Dolly King and Pop Gates. And he was actually the first man to do that. And I think it's to his credit because, it was a start and it helped.
Now that you're retired, are you still doing any consulting?
I'm a consultant. I'm available to be consulted. I hope it's about basketball because otherwise we'd be in trouble. But I'm available. But, the trouble with being consulted too much in basketball is that you're not there every day. You're not in on the daily things that are happening. So it's a little difficult. But a consultant is a guy that you might ask something once in a while. But basically a consultant is a guy that you owe money to. And
an interesting definition. I'll remember that.
Remember that. That if you ever get old enough to get a consultant's job, grab it. It's a great job. The Knicks have been very, very nice. They treat me with a great deal of respect, and it's just a joy to go to the games at the Garden. And my wife and I have a lot of fun, and it keeps us busy. And if I'm there and I can help, I'm always glad to do that.
Red Holzman, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Red Holzman is the former coach of the New York Knicks and is still a team consultant. Our interview was recorded in 1987, 4 years after he retired from coaching. Coming up, Peter Fonda makes a comeback in a new film. This is Fresh Air. Yuli's Gold is a new film by Victor Nunez, starring Peter Fonda. It was a surprise hit at this year's Sundance Film Festival, where audiences were wowed by Fonda's performance. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
Like most people, I got my first strong impression of Peter Fonda from Easy Rider. There's a scene in that movie when the two drug-lugging bikers, played by Fonda and Dennis Hopper, spend the night at a hippie commune. As they leave the next day, Fonda turns to the commune leader and solemnly says, "You're doing your own thing in your own time, man. You should be proud." It was this kind of line, fatuous and flatly delivered, that fixed Fonda's image in the public mind. Seemingly caught in a counterculture time warp, he spent years being the third most famous member of his family, then slipped to fourth when his daughter Bridget hit the screen. Yet American life is filled with comebacks, and Fonda has his in Yuli's Gold, a fine new movie that is itself about a kind of redemption. He plays Yuli Jackson, a beekeeper in the Florida Panhandle, who believes in living one's life as one makes honey, slowly and carefully, according to time-honored rules. But modern life has a way of breaking the rules, and Yuli is forced to raise his grandchildren because his son's in prison and his daughter-in-law is hooked on drugs. In fact, Yuli isn't much of a father or grandfather. Righteous, emotionally remote, his pace is slow as a sleepwalker's. He's most concerned with harvesting his Tupelo honey, whose incomparable mellifluousness was immortalized by a Van Morrison song. But when the family is threatened by two small-time crooks, Yuli is forced to come back to life. He rediscovers the survival skills he'd picked up in Vietnam, and more important, he begins to open up to those around him. This is something he's always found hard to do, as you can hear in the scene when his granddaughter asks him about a photo of his old platoon.
"And they're all dead? Every last one? Except for you. All dead?"
"That's right.
they been bad? Did they deserve to die?
No. No, Penny, they did not.
Why then?
Those were good guys. Your grandpa was tricky. Lucky. That's why I made it out.
Yulee's Gold was written and directed by Victor Nunez, who's best known for Gal Youngin and Ruby in Paradise. Working out of Florida, Nunez is one of the rare American filmmakers who doesn't love ordinary people in the abstract, but actually feels genuine reverence for the rhythms and rituals of their lives. Nunez's movies tend to be slow, partly because he lacks the flair for lyricism, but mainly because he believes in stillness. He finds a profound truth in the methodical way that Yulee dons his beekeeper's mask, carefully removes the special honeycomb trays, and then takes the honey home to be heated and jarred. In fact, the movie's action is built around the contrast between the steady, zen-like concentration of the beekeeper's craft and the screeching brutality of modern America with its drugs, guns, and rampant irresponsibility. It's as if Nunez were contrasting the way he himself makes movies, patiently, lovingly, and with concern for humane values, with the loud, ultra-violent impersonality of Hollywood. He's the filmmaker as beekeeper. This theme might strike us as self-congratulatory, were it not for the majestic performance by Fonda, who here finds the role of a lifetime. Fonda has always been a lagging, drawling, low-energy actor, but for once, these qualities work for him. And because we can see time's handwriting upon him, his hair growing gray, his handsomeness weathered, his lankiness slightly rickety, they take on a new and moving resonance. Fonda has said that playing this role has helped him finally make peace with his father Henry, a cold patriarch whose silent self-righteousness he always found crushing. Quiet and virile, but tinged with a grief that can never quite be spoken or healed, Fonda's Yulee is an uneasy writer who does make us think of his father, as well as the aging Clint Eastwood. It's a delectable irony that an actor who made his name as an icon of 60s rebellion should become, in the 90s, a far more convincing symbol of old-fashioned integrity.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced this week by Joan Tuohy Westman. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Roberta Shurok directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of the new book by Naomi Wolf, Promiscuities: The Secret Struggle for Womanhood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.